Hello, I'm Aaron Lohr, host of the Endocrine News Podcast. In addition to bringing you the latest research breakthroughs and clinical advances from experts in the field, we talk about education, advocacy, career growth, and more from the endocrine perspective. From bench to bedside, from graduate school to practice, from the doctor's office to Capitol Hill, we talk about it all, and it's free to you. So go to www.endocrine.org/podcast or search for Endocrine News Podcast on Apple, Google, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Endocrine Feedback Loop. I am your host, Chase Hendrickson, and welcome you to this Journal Club podcast series brought to you by Endocrine Society. Thanks for joining us as we explore an important article recently published in one of the Society's clinical journals. Today, we look at yet another important article from the JCEM, this time dealing with a common and challenging condition in our pediatric patients. Given the potential impact of its practice-changing findings, this article is important to both adult and pediatric endocrinologists. As usual, understanding the study design will help us better interpret the author's findings and conclusions. And as is usual for Endocrine Feedback Loop, two endocrinologists join me today for this conversation. I host Endocrine Feedback Loop, and as an adult endocrinologist and associate program director at Vanderbilt, I'm excited to delve into the pediatric literature with two experts in that field. So our regular contributor and expert educator today is Marcella Vargas. Marcella practices pediatric endocrinology at Rady Children's Hospital in San Diego and teaches extensively as a faculty member at UC San Diego. She has expertise and a research background in disorders of puberty. And our guest expert this month is Fernando Cazorla from the University of Chile. Fernando is one of the world's experts in disorders of growth and puberty with extensive research and publications in these areas. And that makes him the perfect person to provide input on today's article, as you'll see. And as always, everything we discuss today will be our opinions only and not necessarily those of our respective institutions or of Endocrine Society. This month, we are discussing using kisspeptin to predict pubertal outcomes for youth with pubertal delay. It's primarily out of the Harvard Hospitals in Boston, Massachusetts. And this article was published in the August 2020 print edition of the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology Metabolism with Yiming Chan as the first author. And now, Marcella will start off our conversation by walking us through some of the key points that the authors make in the introduction and helping us understand this topic a little bit more.
Thank you, Chase. So we know that children with constitutional delay of puberty are often indistinguishable at presentation from children with idiopathic hypogonadotropic hypogonadism, or IHH. And both of these entities have significantly different outcomes. It is often difficult to predict which children will progress through puberty, except for those cases in which there's an evident cause for that delayed puberty. These include patients with gonadal failure, hypothalamic or pituitary anatomic abnormalities, or functional hypogonadotropic hypogonadism. But these cases account only for the minority of patients. So given the difficulties differentiating between constitutional delay of puberty and IHH, clinicians oftentimes face the challenge of deciding between treatment with sex steroids versus clinical monitoring only without intervention in patients that present with delayed puberty. So I want to stop here and ask Fernando to please give us an overview of this challenge and also maybe comment on how you approach this problem in your clinical practice.
Thank you, Marcella. I would first like to congratulate you, Chase, and the Endocrine Society for putting together these kinds of virtual journal clubs that are very important to discuss papers that are important in endocrinology in general. Now, the issue that we address today, the differential diagnosis between delayed puberty and hypogonadotropic hypogonadism, is a very important one. And we are faced with this differential diagnosis on a regular basis in our clinics, and we need to make decisions as to whether we're going to wait and see whether the patient develops on his own, or whether we're going to intervene, giving him or her sex steroids in order to speed up the process. Now, this situation has two kind of major dimensions. The first one is the psychological one. It's not easy for a 14-year-old boy or a 13-year-old girl not to develop while the rest of his or her peers are doing so and feeling different from the rest of the class or the rest of the friends is a very difficult thing for any teenager, and particularly for one at that particular age. There's also some physical kind of consequences to this, and it has to do with the fact that many of the patients who consult in our clinics have both delayed puberty and genetic or familial short stature. So this combination produces a situation in which the patient is not only short, but also underdeveloped physically. And this always generates anxiety in the family and the patient. Now, many times in these patients, there's a family history of parents who have gone through the same thing. And sometimes they are the ones who push in order to get this resolved and not to have the patient wait for months and months before they develop. This is an important kind of factor that feeds into the complexity of dealing with these patients. And since what we're trying to do is to reproduce physiology, and physiology indicates to us that puberty should start at the latest, at age 13 in girls and age 14 in boys, you would expect that if we cross those boundaries, the patient should get some help in order to really develop as they should. And this is something that's related to the fact that giving them sex steroids is a relatively non-invasive kind of maneuver in the sense that you can give them at low doses for a relatively short period of time. And during this period, the patient develops a little bit. And if he has or she has only constitutional delay, they will develop ultimately without further intervention. So the pros and cons of waiting too long in these kinds of patients is, in my view, in favor of not waiting for too long a period before you decide whether intervention is necessary. Now, obviously, this should be considered after a certain age. We usually use the boundary of 13 for girls and 14 for boys.
So since differentiating between both diagnoses is so challenging, it'll be helpful to have a prospective method to predict pubertal outcomes. This way, one could establish a clear diagnosis and come up with an appropriate management plan early on. Unfortunately, all the tests that we have available to date have low sensitivity and specificity. These tests are baseline and stimulated LH and FSH and inhibin B. And I'm going to stop here once again because I want Fernando to give us an overview of the currently available diagnostic tools.
Well, this is a kind of a reflection of the long history of endocrinology in trying to make a differential diagnosis between these two entities. If you look at the literature, this effort started in the 80s in trying to find methods that would enable you to differentiate the diagnosis of a constitutional delay versus hypogonadotropic hypogonadism. And there's a long, very long history of different parameters that have been used to try to make this differential diagnosis. For example, for gonadotropins, both LH and FSH, there are some literature that suggests that actually even basal levels of LH and basal levels of FSH can help you in this differential diagnosis. There's a paper by Sequeira published in the Journal of Pediatric Endocrinology in the year 2002 that indicates that in their hands, an LH, basal LH, above 0.65 suggests that the patient actually has constitutional delay and not hypogonadotropic hypogonadism. For basal FSH, another paper published by Rodolfo Rey and his group in JCNM in the year 2010 indicates that the basal FSH above 1.2 is one that will actually suggest that the patient will enter puberty. However, this has not been really confirmed by every investigator, and therefore the basal levels of gonadotropins give you some sense as to whether the patient will enter puberty, but they do not provide a gold standard to make this differential diagnosis. The next step in the history of this differential diagnosis was to administer GnRH, native GnRH, as either a bolus. Martin Savage in the Great Britain has a paper actually in the 80s showing that it can help to differentiate between hypogonadotropic hypogonadism and delayed puberty. But there is a fair amount of overlap anyway. And since native GnRH isn't really that helpful, people have used either GnRH infusions or analogs that have a long-acting power. And Lupron, for example, was tried by Street and others in Fertility and Sterility, published in the year 2002. And Triptorelin, another analog, was tried by Zamboni in Journal of Pediatrics in the late 90s. And even infusions of GnRH were tried also by Rodolfo Rey and his group in Argentina and JCNM in 2010. In general, these kind of publications suggest that you can get a relatively decent separation between the two with relatively good sensitivity, but the specificity is not really that great. That is to say, you detect most patients with hypogonotropic hypogonadism, but you also include patients with late puberty, so you end up having a lower specificity. Later on, even HCG, chorionic gonadotropin, was administered to some of these patients, and Kauschansky has a paper in clinical endocrinology published in the year 2002, giving 1,500 units of HCG for three times, and his kind of conclusions is that it helped him quite a bit in trying to decide whether the patient would enter puberty or not. And Dattani in the UK in the year 2009 published in JCNM using combined GnRH and HCG stimulation to try to make this differential diagnosis. So for gonadotropins, there's a long history of both basal gonadotropin measurements and stimulated gonadotropin measurements that really suggests that it can be helpful in terms of sensitivity, but not that great in terms of specificity. Now, more recently, inhibin B has been presented as a hormone that would help us to make this differential diagnosis. This is based upon a paper of Coutant published in JCNM in the year 2010, looking at 82 boys. These are all studies done in boys, 51 with delayed puberty, 31 with hypogonotropic hypogonadism. And actually in his hands, inhibin B above the level of 35 picograms per ml would suggest that the patient would enter puberty and had constitutional delay and not really hypogonadotropic hypogonadism. However, other authors, Adam in the year 2010 also in France, and Binder, a German group in clinical endocrinology in the year 2015, and Nischlag, another German group published in Andrology in the year 2018, indicate that inhibin B isn't really that great. And even the paper that we will discuss today indicates that inhibin B is again one of these presumed gold standard parameters that doesn't really live up to what the initial literature indicated. Now, just to finish it off, let us say that sometimes even a basal testosterone above 20 nanograms per deciliter early in the morning can help you kind of predict that the patient will most likely enter puberty. But again, there are patients, you know, who will have levels above 20 who actually ultimately end up having hypogonotropic hypogonadism, indicating that this particular test isn't really perfect either. There's other tests like prolactin responses to various stimuli. These were done many, many years ago. They're not in use any longer. Even the adrenarche, that's more delayed in constitutional delay than in hypogonadotropic hypogonadism. But in my view, what this really shows, so many tests presented over so many years, and all of them at some point or another considered as the gold standard to make this diagnosis, have not lived up to what the scrutiny of time. And that, I think, is the main challenge that we face with the current paper, that actually, as with some of the others that we already mentioned, it kind of reviews this, it looks very promising, but further scrutiny of this sometimes doesn't confirm that these tests are actually accurate. So the other thing is, I mean, many of the papers that we already mentioned compare children who have hypogonadotropic hypogonadism and no pubertal development with patients with constitutional delay with early pubertal development. So you're kind of comparing either basal stimulated gonadotropins or inhibin B or testosterone in patients who are already entering puberty compared to those who have not done so. So that is one of the drawbacks in the literature, mostly done in males, and more importantly, some of the group that enters puberty early should be really not part of this study, and we should be comparing children who are prepubertal completely like in the current study, and that's one of the strengths of the current study.
So as we all know, kisspeptin is a neuropeptide secreted from the hypothalamus, which stimulates GnRH secretion. So the idea from the authors of this paper was that performing a stimulation test by administering a stimulatory hormone upstream from GnRH would allow us to identify those patients with defects associated with GnRH production. So I will finalize the introduction section by summarizing that the problem is that the two causes of delayed puberty, both constitutional delay and IHH, are managed differently, but oftentimes they cannot be distinguished from one another. So the hypothesis of this paper is that a child's ability to respond to kisspeptin can predict whether that child will subsequently progress through puberty.
Good. Thank you, Marcella. So I think that's been very nicely laid out with everything that Fernando went through of the many, many tests that have been looked at over decades. And we still haven't really found a good way to differentiate these two groups of patients when it's a really important distinction to be able to make for exactly the points that Marcella highlighted from what the author said. So I think it's a pretty obvious need for why this study was done in the first place and really a nicely stated hypothesis of what they're hoping to understand further. So now we're going to look at the methods a little bit more, and I think as we usually do, understanding the study design will help us understand the results a little bit better. And we've looked at this before, but this is an evaluation of a diagnostic test. So these are a little bit different from particularly observational studies, even though they have lots of similarities. And so I do think it is helpful to compare it to whatever observational study it's most similar to, though you do have to note where the differences are because not all the same rules apply. And really, this study is most similar in its setup to a prospective cohort study. So first of all, for what a prospective cohort study is that it's an observational study and you have a cohort, a group of subjects, a group of individuals, and you split them typically into two groups. You have one group that is exposed and another group that's not exposed or unexposed. And then you follow those groups, those two groups over time, looking for the development of an outcome. And then you compare the exposed versus the unexposed to see if one group develops the outcome more frequently than the other. Now, that's a cohort study. What makes it a prospective cohort is that you have started your study at the very beginning. So retrospective studies wait until everything is over, all of the outcomes have occurred, and that's when the study happens. The prospective cohort study happens at the very beginning. It starts at the very beginning. And with that, that allows you to very tightly control the measure of exposure that you're interested in. And obviously for a diagnostic test, when you're evaluating a diagnostic test, really prospective, even though these are more expensive and they take a lot longer, is really key because you need to be able to study exactly the test that you want to. So if we're going to think of that as the most similar design, the observational prospective cohort study, and then look at how the authors use this. So here, really, if you want to think about it that way, your exposure is going to be your response to kisspeptin stimulation. And then the outcome that you're going to follow all of these subjects over time for is the development of puberty. And because of this prospective nature, you can really very well compare these two groups because there's going to be uniformity. We'll look at the protocol, but it's going to be identical for all of the individuals in this study. And another key component here that would have been very challenging for any sort of a retrospective study is that the authors are very careful in their study. The investigators are careful to make sure that sex steroids, so Fernando walked through why you might start sex steroids in individuals in this situation, and they're able to plan for those to be stopped before this testing is done, which is key, as we'll talk about here in a second. And one other point, and I think this is an important one to make, as to where a study of a diagnostic test would be different from just a standard observational study, is that confounding is maybe less of an issue here. If you had an observational study, you would be very worried about the possibility of a confounder. So as a reminder, a confounder being something that's related to what you've labeled as your exposure, but it's this confounder that's actually driving the outcome occurring or not occurring. A good example here might be BMI. So if you look at some of the data that the authors provide, the BMI is not exactly the same in these two groups. And if this were just an observational study and the authors were trying to make the point of it's the presence or absence of kisspeptin, say, that's causing an outcome, then you would have to account for things like BMI because that could actually be what's driving it. It becomes less relevant when you're talking about we're simply trying to identify a diagnostic test. We're looking at a test. Did they respond? Did they not respond? Is that going to predict the outcome of interest? So while helpful to keep in mind, it's probably less important here. So to look at the actual criteria for this study, the inclusion criteria for girls in the study, they had to be at least the age of 12. Boys had to be 13 and a half. And they would enroll patients with either delayed or stalled puberty. And that assessment was based on, for girls, breast development, and for boys, testicular volume. And as exclusion criteria, if there had been an identifiable cause of the delayed puberty, and Marcella mentioned those as she went through the introduction, if the investigators identified the cause, those individuals were excluded. And so the population that we're interested in here, these were all children who were referred to Boston Children's Hospital. Some of them were from Boston, but there were individuals from across the United States. And the way the protocol worked is it required two admissions to the CRC. And when they did that, these were overnight admissions, and there were frequent labs every 10 minutes. And these labs were measuring overnight LH secretion. They were also measuring LH secretion in response to kisspeptin. This is before and after priming with GnRH. And also LH secretion in response to GnRH, again, before and after priming with GnRH. And so I did think this would be helpful as we're trying to understand this protocol, why it works this way, is getting Fernando's input to understand this whole idea of GnRH priming and why you might need to do that if you're trying to understand how LH is going to respond to both kisspeptin and to GnRH itself. So Fernando, can you shed some light onto why that priming is a potentially important part?
Yeah, this is a relatively invasive study. The protocol requires two admissions, a fair number of samples obtained every 10 minutes. So this is not something that you would do in clinical practice. But what's the reason for the priming in which GnRH at 75 nanograms per kilo was given every 2 hours for 6 days? So this is quite long. Well, in prepubertal children, there is a minimal endogenous GnRH secretion in general. So pituitary responses may be attenuated. That's physiology. So to ensure that endogenous GnRH can be detected, all subjects received, in this case, exogenous, GnRH for 6 days, which the goal is to enhance pituitary responses to GnRH. Now, it's an interesting research tool, but you wonder whether it's absolutely necessary. As I say, this was not a simple protocol to carry on, but this is a rationale. The fact that because these prepubertal children have minimal endogenous GnRH secretion, the pituitary responses may be attenuated in these patients. So you try to wake up, so to speak, the pituitary by giving them GnRH exogenously over a period of 6 days. But as I say, this is mostly a research tool.
Thank you. That's helpful to help us understand that. So then that's the way that the investigators looked at the exposure. And we'll talk about those results here in a minute. And then what they did to follow these individuals over time for the outcome is that every 6 months, these individuals had an exam and labs. If the individuals were on exogenous sex steroids, then they would hold those for between 2 and 6 weeks, and that depended upon the type and the route of the sex steroid that they were taking. Now, one thing, as I was looking at this and trying to understand this a little bit more, I did not see that there was any comment on blinding. And we mostly think about this as being relevant for RCTs, but blinding can be important in these sort of studies because if an investigator knows whether one of the subjects responded or did not respond to the testing, then it could potentially affect how that investigator would look for the presence or the absence of an outcome. And I didn't see that specifically commented on. So certainly it was something that I was wondering about. And And Marcella helped me understand this a little bit more, and I thought it would be helpful to look at one of the examples. So the authors did a great job. They provided all really of their raw data and supplements, and I was looking at that. This gets a little bit into the results, but I was looking at a couple of the female subjects in the study, one of them who was labeled as a responder. We'll look at that here in a second. One of them who was not actually looked relatively similar. In the sense that both of these individuals were treated with exogenous sex steroids. Both of them had development, breast development. And also, when they were measured at the very end, so up to 18 years of age, was the latest that the studies went for these individuals, is that both of them had undetectable estradiol levels whenever those sex steroids were held. And so I wanted Marcella to walk us through that, because I think it makes a little bit more sense as to how you might evaluate the male patients. That's testicular growth. That's going to give you a sense. Have they gone through puberty? Have they not? But it gets much more complicated, it would seem, with the female patients, because your exogenous sex steroids are going to lead to breast development when that's not the case with testicular development. So Marcella, can you walk us through kind of how that might work as far as that assessment, and then potentially whether that might have an impact if the investigators are blinded or not?
Sure. So yes, in females, breast center staging cannot be used to evaluate for progression of puberty when exogenous sex steroids are being given. And that's for the reason that you just mentioned, that of course exogenous estrogen can induce breast growth and development. There are, however, surrogate markers that can be used, such as the ones that the investigators reported. So for example, in subject B, the LH level, while not robust, as you mentioned, it was over 1. So by definition, this will be pubertal. So there's different data out there, but I think most people will agree that an LH level over 0.3 to 1 is definitely in that pubertal category. And so this patient with that level being over 1 does fall into that pubertal range. So by definition, we can say that based on her LH level, she was in puberty. Now, a more important point is that she did receive exogenous sex steroids. However, these were only given for a very short period of time. She received sex steroids from ages 15.4 to 15.7, this subject B that you were mentioning. And she was at a Tanner stage 1 at enrollment when she was 15 years old. And when the study was completed, she was at a Tanner stage 4. And so while not impossible, it will be very unlikely to go from a Tanner stage 1 breast to a 4 with such a short period of steroids, exogenous steroids. And we do not know the dose that she received, but even with high dose, these will be unlikely. So this, along with the fact that her LH was in the pubertal range, do make me think that this subject was definitely in puberty. The low estradiol level does not rule out puberty. We know that estradiol fluctuates physiologically, and so patients even in puberty can have low levels. So while a high or normal level can confirm puberty, a low level cannot exclude it.
Thanks, Marcella. Yeah, that was really helpful. And so I wanted you to explain that, because that really helped me understand that when you explained that to me before, somebody who doesn't do this on a routine basis. And I think while obviously really in the weeds looking at some of the supplemental data that's there, I do think it's something that you always want to think about if there's not clear statements of whether investigators were blinded during these studies, and that could potentially affect your how you would interpret this. But looking at, there really were very few instances to where that would be a concern. And just like Marcella explained, it does seem that these individuals, based on the data that's been provided, were appropriately allocated in these groups. So just to finally wrap up the method section here with some of the lab testing that was done, the authors point out that if the children lived in the Boston area, then labs were done, the follow-up labs, at really only one of a couple of labs that were used. If the children lived outside of Boston, they were done with the local provider at whatever local lab was utilized. And so I was curious there, and Fernando, maybe you can chime in here, as to would it make a difference if we're talking about estradiol and testosterone, gonadotropin levels, those are ones primarily being used to follow these kids over time. Is that going to make a difference if they're using multiple labs, or are these assays relatively standardized and wouldn't make a huge difference if they're using different labs to try to answer this question?
Well, definitely. I think that the question of having several assays performed in different labs with different methodology has an impact on the results. And I understand this is a difficult study to perform. As we indicated before, there were over 100 patients invited to participate, and only 17 completed both admissions. So essentially, the fact that they had many patients that they invited to participate, and they only ended up with a fraction of them participating in the study, suggests that actually it was difficult from a logistical point of view to centralize all measurements in just one lab. But you're right, Chase. Actually, the ultra-sensitive assays that we use, for example, for gonadotropins now, immunochemiluminometric, immunofluorometric, or electrochemiluminometric, give you somewhat different results. The chemiluminometric assays in general show lower values than the fluorometric assays with the same sample. So if you're defining cutoff points and you have different labs, you may have some trouble interpreting the data. Now, in this particular study, I was looking this up, and most of the labs that they used for the most part immunochemiluminometric assays. So at least they attempted to standardize the technique, even though it was done in different labs. But this is a major problem in other places that don't have access to these assays, and in which they have to set up their own cutoff points to decide whether the patient is below a certain threshold or above a certain threshold. And that is a challenge for every clinician who is taking care of these patients all around the world, in which you decide which laboratory are you using, which technique is being used by that lab, and what are the intra-assay and inter-assay coefficients of variation. For sex steroids, you know, particularly for testosterone, there's recent data suggesting, you know, that the old methods that we used in the past to measure testosterone freely should be improved. And there's a fair amount of data coming up with sex steroids and liquid chromatography, mass spectrometry kind of methods that are much more reliable. So it's correct that in general, for this kind of study with a relatively limited number of patients, you would want to have as standardized as possible the laboratory techniques to measure these different hormones.
So we will keep that in mind as we move forward. And then just one final word is that a subset of these subjects had whole exome sequencing, and we will look at that in the results section. And Marcella is going to walk us through that, so I will turn it back over to her.
So there were a total of 17 subjects included, all of which had delayed or stalled puberty. 5 were girls and 12 were boys. One subject was lost to follow-up, so we will discuss the results for a total of 16 subjects.
And I'll chime in here, and Fernando, I just mentioned it, is that 117 people, subjects were invited, but only 17 actually started this study. So I do think it is worth pointing out, it is not at all surprising. Fernando's done a great job of walking us through and pointing out how complicated this is. So it's not surprising that they had trouble getting a lot of individuals to do this. But I think you do always need to be aware of when you have a relatively small percentage of individuals accepting invitations to participate in studies is that these individuals may not be totally representative of the general population that you are studying. It's not always easy to identify what that is, and it may not be any difference whatsoever, but certainly something worth keeping in the back of your mind as you evaluate these results.
And let me chime in here, Chase, because when you look at figure one, from the over 100 patients that actually were invited to participate, 83 declined. In many studies, what you see is that the loss of patients takes place for other reasons, because maybe they don't fulfill all the inclusion criteria or other things. In this particular case, because the study was so prolonged and have a couple of admissions to the hospital, it's no surprise that actually they ended up having almost 80% of the patients just declined participation. And this is something that is kind of a testament to the complicated kind of protocol that they had to put together in order to answer this question.
So I'm going to start with the results to the kisspeptin simulation test. So 8 out of 16 subjects were kisspeptin responders, which the authors defined as those who had an LH response over 0.8 MIUs per ml. Two of the subjects in this group were girls and six were boys. The remainder eight were either quispeptin non-responders or intermediate responders. There were seven subjects in the non-responder group and one subject in the intermediate responder group. Non-responders were defined as those with the LH levels from 0 to 0.1, and the intermediate responder had an LH level of 0.4. There were two girls and six boys in this group as well. So when we assess which of the subjects progressed through puberty, we can see that the responses to quispeptin clearly distinguished those who later progressed through puberty from those who did not. So all responders, all quispeptin responders, went through puberty. All non-responders and the intermediate responder did not go through puberty. The p-value was calculated as 0.002, and the sensitivity and specificity for the quispeptin simulation test were 100%. These results are very nicely shown in figure 3, where we can clearly see a distinct segregation of both groups when we look at the LH levels after quispeptin simulation. And in this figure, we can also nicely see how there were similar responses in boys and girls. So now I want to go over the results for the other tests. The authors also checked random LH and FSH levels, as well as GnRH-stimulated LH levels. And the results for all these tests overlapped between both groups, meaning the ones that progressed through puberty and the ones who did not. So these tests were not predictive of pubertal outcomes, at least in this study. The results for nighttime frequent LH sampling showed that subjects with LH pulses all advanced through puberty, so this was predictive. But on the other hand, the lack of pulses were deemed as not predictive, as eight subjects with no pulses did not progress, but two subjects did progress. It is, however, very important to note that these two subjects that had no LH pulsatility but did progress through puberty were on sex steroids at the time of the testing, so there could have been some negative feedback suppressing the LH pulsatility. So I want to ask Chase and Fernando, what are your thoughts regarding whether you think, is this truly not predictive, or might these have been predictive if the subjects were actually not taking sex steroids?
I would chime in here and say that I was looking at that, and as the authors say, well, this didn't predict at all. They came up with a very plausible explanation where the two individuals that it wasn't predictive for, why it may not have been because of that exogenous sex steroid use. And then so if you exclude them, which always concerns when you have to exclude somebody, but if you did, then otherwise it would be perfectly predictive. So yeah, again, not as perfect, and it gets a little bit more complicated when you have to think about the sex steroid, but I do think it would be at least worth considering that if that's not in the picture, this may actually be just as predictive as the quispeptin stimulation test. Again, we don't know that for sure, but maybe not, shouldn't be so quick to discredit this and say, yeah, this isn't predictive.
Well, there's no question that the sex steroid treatment must have had some impact on endogenous gonadotropin secretion, even though it was actually interrupted, discontinued sometime before the actual assessment. But I think this clouds a little bit our interpretation of the data, because it's entirely possible that the sex steroid administration during a prolonged period of time, even though it was discontinued before the actual assessment, may have had something to do with attenuated gonadotropin secretion profile overnight. So I think we cannot answer that question, because we don't have a bigger group of patients. Actually, here there were only two patients who had this problem. But I would tend to think that actually, most likely, the sex steroid administration over a relatively prolonged period of time may have had something to do with the attenuated gonadotropin profile overnight. I think it's entirely reasonable. We cannot confirm it. We don't have a total proof, but it's very likely that it did.
So another test they looked at was inhibin B in boys. And we also see overlap between both groups. So this was not a predictive marker in this study. And lastly, genetic testing with exome sequencing was done in a subset of subjects, and the results were not predictive either. So of the subjects who underwent genetic testing, five progressed through puberty and six did not. Of the five that progressed through puberty, two had a pathogenic or likely pathogenic variant, and they had mutations in either FGFR1 or TACR3. In the group that did not progress through puberty, pathogenic or likely pathogenic variants were identified in only two. These subjects had mutations in FGFR1 and ANOS1. So I want to ask you, Fernando, to please comment on the surprising finding of pathogenic variants in participants who actually did end up going through puberty.
Before I answer that, let me just point out, Marcelo, that from your discussion about results, it becomes clear that basal LH and FSH, GnRH stimulated LH, and inhibin E in this particular study with a very long follow-up of 4 years did not really help to make this differential diagnosis, even though, as I indicated at the beginning, some authors have suggested that they do. So I think this study helps also to dispel some notions that actually some of these previous tools that have been used to make this differential diagnosis really aren't really very helpful. Particularly important is inhibin B that was touted as one of the really promising stars in this differential diagnosis. And when you look in the paper at the actual figure, you know, that's figure 4, there's a fair amount of overlap. I just want to mention this. Inhibin B in those who did not progress to puberty was from 17 up to 48, and the ones who progressed from puberty from 39 up to 209. So the 35 picogram per ml cutoff point of cotant actually was not confirmed in this study at all. And I think that is an additional strength of the study, that it helps to criticize some of the previous data suggesting that some of these other parameters might be useful. Now, regarding the genetic testing, I think it's very important. We get here into a very interesting area because there's a shared genetic basis for self-limited delayed puberty and idiopathic hypogonotropic hypogonadism. This has been shown by the Mass General Group, JCNM 2015, the same author, actually, Chan and Seminara, looking at this and indicating that when they reviewed two cohorts, one with delayed puberty and IHH in the same family, the proband variant was shared by 53% of the patients who had delayed puberty in these families. That is to say, the patients who had delayed puberty and not IHH, 53% of them in these families shared the same kind of variation, genetic basis. And the second cohort they looked at were patients with delayed puberty and with no IHH in their families, and 14% of these patients, 14%, 1/4, had variants potentially pathogenic, particularly in TAC3 and IL17RD. These are genes that tend to occur variants in patients who have only delayed puberty. So there's a shared genetic basis for this. So I think there's a relatively widespread consensus that actually looking at genetic studies in these patients will not help you to discriminate whether they have delayed puberty or they have IHH, because some patients with delayed puberty, like in this particular study, had pathogenic or likely pathogenic variants. So in essence, the answer is absolutely, patients can have variants in some of these genes, even though they only have delayed puberty and not IHH.
So now what we'll do is we'll take a look at the discussion and the conclusion, and we'll look both at what the authors conclude, and then we'll give you some of our own thoughts. We've been doing that along the way, but we'll try to bring that together at the end. So to start with some of the conclusions that the authors come up with. So first of all, is they state that the response to kisspeptin really cleanly distinguishes those who would later progress through puberty and those who did not. And they also state that the kisspeptin stimulation test performs superiorly to other available tests because those other tests did not accurately make that prediction. And some of the advantages that they note of kisspeptin stimulation is that it can predict these pubertal outcomes very early on. So you can see positive responses in children who will eventually go through puberty, even when on exam they're prepubertal. And they also point out that this is appears equally as effective in individuals with either delayed puberty or stalled puberty. So it doesn't seem to make a difference between those two groups. And additionally, we talked about this with one of the other tests, is that the kisspeptin stimulation test does not seem to be affected by the exogenous sex steroid. So certainly an advantage there. A couple of disadvantages that they note. So one of them, probably not a very big one, is that any individual with one of the rare upstream issues, that this test, the kisspeptin stimulation test, would not be helpful, though the authors point out that these are thought to be extremely uncommon, so probably would not be many individuals that this would affect. A more common issue, though, is that this test cannot predict when puberty will progress. And I think this is obviously really important, because if you have a positive test, but it's still going to be several years until puberty starts, you may still want to start exogenous sex steroids, but this test, unfortunately, is not going to give you that information, so you're still left being uncertain with that really important question. And so I think it's important that the authors point that out as a limitation of this testing. So a few strengths of this study that the authors note. They point out the strength of it being prospective with longitudinal follow-up, which we talked about before, really key in any study like this to have that. They point out strengths that it includes both boys and girls. As Fernando reviewed for us, not all studies in the past have done that. And the authors also point out that there are very thorough neuroendocrine profiles, and that several different tests are included and compared. And again, as Fernando pointed out, often these studies in the past have been of just one. So it definitely is a strength, I think, of this study, is that there are multiple that are compared. A couple of additional ones that I would note on there is that it certainly does seem to be an innovative study with what they're looking at here. And as we've talked about repeatedly, is a huge unmet need area. So I think important from that perspective. Some limitations of this study that the authors note, they point out, as we've talked about, that there are a small number of subjects, and that you would need a larger number if you really wanted to establish a cutoff of what is a positive response. And we talked about this, Marcella talked about some of these numbers. Most of the non-responders, it was pretty obvious. The LH didn't bump up at all. But there was one individual who had that intermediate response. The LH went up to 0.4, not all the way up to the 0.8. And so the authors say we really would need a lot more individuals in a study like this to understand what that cutoff is. And so I thought it would be helpful, particularly with Fernando and Marcella's experience in these areas, as to what would that look like to have a large-scale study with as complicated of a protocol, at least as they had to use here. How challenging, how feasible would it be to do something like that?
So, you know, as we mentioned earlier, enrollment in a study where long-term follow-up is needed and where frequent testing is required can be extremely challenging. So without a doubt, any sort of study of, you know, this type will be challenging in terms of enrollment. Now, this particular protocol was cumbersome because it included priming. It also included nighttime sampling. So if you think about a study, a large-scale study, where only the response to kisspeptin will be evaluated, maybe some of these things will be excluded, like the nighttime sampling. The priming might not even be completely necessary, as you know, when we compare the results between kisspeptin response, LH response to kisspeptin, before and after priming, the results were not really that different. So a larger scale study could help us differentiate whether this is needed or not. But also there could be studies where if the nighttime sampling is excluded, for example, enrollment might be easier as the protocol will be more simple.
Let me just add that this study was conducted at one of the biggest centers in the world for delayed puberty and hypogonotropic hypogonadism, with a well-earned reputation for really producing valuable new data that helps clinicians all around the world. Under these conditions, if they actually had 83 patients declining to participate, you can imagine how difficult it would be to perform the kind of large study that would be necessary to confirm these data. So I kind of feel that even though this is very necessary, it's not easy to do a study like this, not as much as Marcella was saying because of the two admissions and the priming. If you look at figure 2, actually the kisspeptin responses for the patient who was a non-responder was equally poor either before priming or after priming. So in essence, really priming doesn't really help very much for gestapentin. So I think that the priming, I think at least based upon these data, does not appear to be necessary to elicit a gestapentin response that the patient will respond. In the same figure, participant B, a responder, had about the same response to, you know, gestapentin with either before priming or after priming. So at least we may be able to think of a simpler protocol that would be necessary, but what would make things difficult is the long follow-up. Here you need several years of follow-up. Remember, the only gold standard we have to make this differential diagnosis is to examine the patient clinically at age 18 and to say this one entered puberty, therefore he doesn't have HH. And if he does not enter puberty, you say he may have HH. So that's a not very elegant way to make this final diagnosis when you have to wait until age 18 to make the final diagnosis. So I think that having a test of this sort would help us, in addition to some of the other parameters that we would measure in these patients, clinically and hormonally, in order to decide whether a patient will require exogenous sex steroid for a very prolonged period of time or not. But my sense is that actually the problem with this is essentially the long follow-up. It's difficult to, when a patient enters puberty at age 15 or so, if he has the late puberty, they're likely not to return to the clinic. No matter how many times you call them or whatever, they may tell you the patient is developing. So there's a logistical kind of block here in trying to develop a study that will hopefully study the response to gestapentin with a very long follow-up to ensure that the patient either enters or does not enter puberty.
And we will come back in just a minute here and look at some of those concerns from a slightly different angle. And as far as limitations go, the only other thing that I would add, it's not truly a limitation, but I would say because of this protocol that's been outlined, it's really not yet translatable into practice. And so I do think we want to think about practice itself with these articles as we go through them. I think one thing that we always want to end with is a discussion of, is this practice changing? I don't think the authors are arguing that it should be now, but I think what we should be thinking about is in the future, particularly the near future, might this be practice changing? Is this something that we need to be looking for as a potential aid in a challenging area where we've not had anything as good as this? So the first question I think that I would ask for our group is just about the amount of data that we have right now. Yes, it's a relatively small study. We don't have the cutoffs, but I think probably a different question I would have is what Fernando has alluded to before, is that you'll have many of these studies that are done and you have one promising study, and then it gets repeated often by a different group elsewhere, and they don't see the same responses. So for Marcel and Fernando, is that a concern with this study? Do we really feel like this needs to be repeated at maybe a different center to feel confident in this, or do we feel pretty good with where we're at right now?
So while promising and exciting as a new tool, as alluded to earlier, we definitely do need larger studies to confirm the ability of the test to accurately predict pubertal outcomes. So we need to confirm that the results actually are reproducible. Also, we will need to establish more precise cutoffs, and then we will also need to establish whether the need for priming is true or not. Well, we think that it will be very challenging to have a larger scale study given the challenges with enrollment due to the long-term follow-up that is required. If this could be done, and once clear cutoffs are established and we do understand that the test is actually accurate and can predict pubertal outcomes, then this will definitely could be practice-changing. We do face this challenge often in clinic where we try to differentiate whether a patient has idiopathic hypogonadotropic hypogonadism versus constitutional delay. And I'm sure that if there was a test that, you know, does pass the test of time, as we were discussing earlier, many of us pediatric endocrinologists will be eager to use it and implement it in our clinical practice.
Well, Chase, the question is very clear. Is there enough data to be certain of this approach? I would say definitely not. I think that at this stage of the game, we have a promising tool that may help us if it's confirmed in other groups and with a larger group, number of patients. But to have enough data to be certain of this approach at this stage of the game, I would say definitely not. It's a very promising approach, but we need more data. And I would add here that remember that gizpeptin here was measured in samples obtained every 10 minutes over several hours. When you look at the protocol, they administer gizpeptin on the first time. You know, they show the protocol here in figure two. It's administered at 6 a.m. and they look at response to gizpeptin over 4 hours with samples every 10 minutes. And in admission two, after pituitary priming, they do exactly the same thing. They administer gizpeptin, you know, at 9 a.m. and then they look at gonadotropins over the next 4 hours, every 10 minutes. And this obviously is too cumbersome and too complicated that one would hope that one can do a regular stimulation test with a baseline and another sample obtained X minutes after the administration of gizpeptin to really determine whether this is useful or not. So I would say at this stage of the game, very promising, but we need more data.
And then the final question that I would have for both of you, we've talked about how complicated this is from a study perspective, but then as we think about, well, what if this, say it is done at multiple sites and it continues to look as promising as this, what would that look like to try to turn it into a protocol that would actually work? Because obviously doing this frequent testing for multiple hours would be extremely challenging to make that something that could be used in clinical practice. So what might need to be done in order to make this a feasible test that pediatric endocrinologists like you two could regularly employ for your patients?
Well, if you look at their results, the response to gizpeptin in terms of gonadotropins in figure two tends to occur mostly within the first hour. Then kind of decreases slowly. So if one were to envision a stimulatory test that administers gizpeptin at this particular dose, you know, and 0.313 micrograms per kilo IV, and then obtains samples, let's say 30, 60, and maybe 90 minutes, very much the same way we do provocative tests for growth hormone, well, that would get a little closer to general practice. And people would say, if you administer gizpeptin at this particular dose and you get a baseline and then you get three samples post-administration and you look at the delta in LH and it's above 0.4, like it was in this case, but maybe it's going to be different once we do it with less samples, that I think would hold a fair amount of promise for clinical practice if it were to become that.
Yeah, so I think both the timing, as Fernando just alluded to, and then also the priming, as we discussed earlier, if we do determine that priming is indeed not necessary to accurately evaluate the LH response to gizpeptin, then that will also simplify the protocol for the test and therefore make it more appealing for clinical practice.
And I would add to this study overall, and it was one of the reasons that we were excited to present this, is that it's an extremely well-done study. And obviously, even if it's not ready for clinical practice yet, exciting enough and promising enough that it warranted a discussion from a couple of experts on the subject. And as Fernando mentioned, comes from a group with a well-earned reputation for excellence in this area.
I think we are based upon two conditions that are not distinct always. You know, we tend to think about the differential diagnosis between disease X and disease Y, and they're different. And therefore, there should be some kind of tool that would enable you to make the separation. In this particular case, remember that there are a fair amount of literature on reversible IHH, you know, patients with idiopathic hypogonadism who actually revert. And this has been published extensively again by the Boston group, JCNM 2014, 308 patients with IHH, of which 44 actually reversed. And some of them reversed at about the age of 18. So when you look at one of these patients and the patient reverts at age 18, does the patient have hypogonadotropic hypogonadism? Or does the patient have really delayed puberty? So in my view, this is what complicates a little bit this field, the fact that we have two conditions that overlap, and there's a shared kind of genetic kind of background in some of these families, and even the clinical picture can be quite similar in those patients who revert. And who's to say that the patient who reverted, quote unquote, at the age of 18 actually only had the late puberty rather than IHH? Now, the one who reverted at age 40, I would understand, would be more likely to have IHH. But I bring this up because it's not that clear that these two clinical conditions are really totally separate entities.
And with that, I would like to thank Marcela Vargas and Fernando Cazorla for joining us for this month's edition of Endocrine Feedback Loop. I hope that you all, as our listeners, enjoyed and benefited from our conversation, and look for next month's edition to be released in mid-September. And now you're in the loop. This has been Endocrine Feedback Loop. Endocrine Feedback Loop is brought to you as a members-only benefit of Endocrine Society with special production oversight by Maggie Graham.
Hello, I'm Aaron Lohr, host of the Endocrine News Podcast. In addition to bringing you the latest research breakthroughs and clinical advances from experts in the field, we talk about education, advocacy, career growth, and more from the endocrine perspective. From bench to bedside, from graduate school to practice, from the doctor's office to Capitol Hill, we talk about it all, and it's free to you. So go to www.endocrine.org/podcast or search for Endocrine News Podcast on Apple, Google, or wherever you get your podcasts.